Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an amazing founder joining us. We're going to be talking about what she has been able to build with her team. You know, remarkable, you know, the journey. You know, they've been at it for over almost two decades, actually. And 2,000, you know, employees, according to Crunchbase, over 800 million raised, incredible investors like TCV, Blackstone, and so forth. So I think it'll be amazing, you know, the podcast that we have in front of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Joanna Smorus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Perfect pronunciation. That's the best I've ever heard, I have to say.
I love it. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life being born and raised, you know, there in Helsinki, in a place called Kirkkonummi?
That was not quite perfect, but Kirkkonummi, yes. So that's a small place just outside of Helsinki. I think my childhood was very ordinary, you know, basic Finnish stuff. You walk to school, you occasionally ski, you do all those things. What was maybe a bit unique for me and probably had a huge impact on me going into engineering was that my mother actually died when I was only 2 years old. So I've been raised by a single dad engineer. And I don't know what he did, but somehow he managed to make engineer out of both of his kids. So myself and my brother ended up studying at the Helsinki University of Technology, just like my father. I think for me, engineering was the kind of normal way of doing things. And anything else would have required a bit more thinking. So I do think my dad had a huge impact on those kind of fairly important life decisions that I made later in life.
How do you think that engineering and problem solving has served you in life? Because it sounds like problem solving was something that was ingrained, you know, in you, especially with your dad.
Yeah, I think he really kind of he relied on us to make our own decisions. But the thing he always asked about was, how did the math exam go? How did the physics exam go? And then he didn't care too much about the other things. And he also had a lot of patience. If there was something I didn't understand, he really, you know, went through all the steps to make it get it. And then, of course, he exposed us to a lot of pop culture things on science, so these interesting findings. And that's actually something I'm trying to pass on to my daughter now. When you see something interesting, science, biology, whatnot, I try to share those insights with her and see how, you know, it's quite inspiring to see what you can do and all the amazing animals, for example, we have on this planet.
And obviously, you know, every event that happens around us, you know, shapes who we are. So I guess perhaps in this case, you know, not having the mother figure, you know, fortunately, given the event when you were 2 years old, how do you think that also that shaped you at a personal level? And then also, how do you think that helped you with, you know, anything else, you know, that came your way in the future?
I think it's, of course, hard to know because this is the cards you were dealt. So you don't have anything to compare with. But of course, yeah. One thing I think was had a massive impact is that my dad did everything in home. We didn't have like male chores or female chores because there were only adult chores and kids chores. And I think that was actually quite healthy in that sense that I did see that, you know, if you need to, you will use power tools. If you need to, you will use a sewing machine. If you need to, you color the pictures in the picture book to entertain your kids. So that was really a good showcase that you know, humans are humans and we can play all those parts as needed.
So in your case, you went on to study engineering. And then after studying engineering, essentially, you went into research. So out of all things, why did you choose research as your path to follow?
Yeah, I actually didn't really choose it. It wasn't an active choice. It was a lucky coincidence, I would say. I managed to land a summer job in the research group and then continued on from there to write my master's thesis as part of the research they were doing. And then they managed to get some additional funding and they offered me the opportunity to stay on and do a PhD. And at that point, I've already written a couple of papers and it felt like, why not? Why not do this thing when you have this opportunity? And of course, I really enjoyed working with the research group. They were doing a lot of cool new things. And my supervisor feels like he was always at least 10 years ahead of the curve, which has also made it a bit problematic sometimes for him. Because back in the day, you know, 2000, early 2000, he was really excited about things like Internet of Things. It didn't become a thing until later. 3D printing, it didn't become a thing until later. And we were doing quite a lot of research on, for example, e-grocery that became a thing a bit later. But that was a really cool and exciting environment to be in that really kind of pushed you to look into things and be curious and really study what you felt was interesting and exciting. And that's, it was fun to be there. But then at some point, you know, the clock is ticking and I'm a bit of an overachiever. And in Finland at that time, people typically finished their dissertations in, you know, 4.5 years. That was kind of the standard time to do it. And I was like, okay, now I spent 4 years on this, so now I need to wrap it up and complete my dissertation. And I did that. And then it was time to, you know, look forward again.
And you had the opportunity to, during the research years, to basically, because it was like almost 7 years that you were doing research, so you had the opportunity to meet your co-founders, you know, for your business, for Relay. So how was that? You know, how was meeting them? How did you guys connect? Where were the skill sets, you know, blending in? And what was that moment like where you all felt like it was time to launch a business? I mean, walk us through the sequence of events.
Yeah, I think we actually knew each other already earlier. So we've all studied the same thing, industrial engineering and management. But then we started working together in that research group. And I think my relationship with Mikko was a bit different because we were on the same level. We had done our studies at the same time and we kind of finished our dissertations at the same time. Whereas Michael is a couple of years younger. So he actually did his master's thesis with me as his supervisor. But what I did get to know was their work ethics. And also, you know, intelligence. So if there's something that's kind of a common trait for the three of us is that we really enjoy problem solving and we love the challenge of having an interesting problem to kind of pick apart and solve better. So something, for example, we were working on together was automated store replenishment. And we did our research together with some companies that were piloting different things and gave us access to data. And we could do simulations and suggest new things. And we were, for example, looking at fresh product because everyone had automated the simple things like canned food. Nothing much happens, but nobody had automated fresh products. Nobody had automated promotions. Nobody had automated the like really seasonal products. And we got the opportunity then to try to figure out how you could actually do that. Can you do it? And then use these company partners' data to do simulations. And we were quite excited that, yes, I really think we can do this better. But then, you know, it's hard to get things implemented when you do research. So we felt that we were, you know, coming up with clever ideas, writing research papers, but then what happens in practice? So I think that was the kind of key driver for us then leaving at academia and going into, you know, entrepreneurship, trying to actually build these things so that we could really see how they can be implemented and what results they will deliver, and then kind of be able to further improve on that.
So then in this case here, you know, like how was the, why did you guys think that the problem was meaningful enough to jump in, you know? Because obviously you guys are very customer focused. So how was the, you know, like really having the problem in front of you, analyzing it, looking at it, and then being like, it's time. What was that day where you were all sitting down and you were like, let's go?
Yeah, I think the kind of business case was really a no-brainer. And that was the reason why companies had started to automate these things already. Because back in the day, ordering in store happened manually. People walked around in the stores and punched in numbers. I need one case of this. Maybe I'll take two of this one. And, you know, even in a small convenience store, you have thousands of SKUs. And then in these mega centers, you have tens of thousands. It just takes a lot of time to do that. And to do it well, you should be able to, you know, factoring, let's say, weekday variation, shopping patterns look different on different days. Then you have seasonality, you have holidays, you have promotions, you have cannibalization. So if one product is promoted, maybe another one drops in sales. And maybe you have some halo effects that, you know, if people buy a promoted, let's say, hot dog sausage, maybe they don't want the buns as well, and so on and so forth. So the business case was a no-brainer. Huge time savings, huge impact on on-shelf availability, which is, of course, key to sales because especially in physical stores, it's really hard to sell if you don't have the goods. But then also a huge business case in driving down inventory levels and removing waste, so obsolescence, spoilage, all those negative things you have then when you have too much stock. So that was kind of a no-brainer. But then I think the moment when we went into this was when we decided that, you know, we finished our PhDs with Mikko and we're thinking, you know, you could go continue on the research path, maybe go into a corporation to work with these things, maybe go into consulting. But then we kind of agreed that it would be really cool to do something of our own and see if it really works. So I think that was the moment. And then we decided that we'll give it a shot. We'll see if we can make this fly. But of course, you know, we all have decent education and some work experience and so on. So it wasn't like a huge leap of faith if we hadn't, you know, been successful in getting things off the ground. The worst thing would probably have been that we would have needed to get real jobs.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So I guess for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of RELEX Solutions? How do you guys make money?
So in essence, we are a SaaS company, so software as a service. We started out with doing, as said, store replenishment, but then, of course, we've expanded across the whole supply chain. So we work with all the way from manufacturing to the consumers, manufacturers, distribution centers, retailers, the whole supply chain. And then we've also expanded our offering to adjacent areas. So, for example, space optimization in stores. It really has a huge impact on store replenishment, how much space you've allocated to different products in stores. And then, of course, promotion planning. Again, something we saw quite often when we were doing the promotion forecasting for clients is that there's actually quite a lot of completely useless promotions out there, promotions that don't really move the needle and, in worst case, actually lose money. So that was also kind of a no-brainer that if this is the starting point, there has to be a better way. So we acquired a promotion planning company and have been developing those capabilities since. So yeah, a SaaS company, we charge our clients money for using our services. And then the aim is that everyone is super happy with the savings, the increased sales that they are seeing, and never leave us. And that's pretty much the story.
That's amazing. So in your guys' case, I mean, according to Crunchbase, I was saying that you guys have raised over $800 million. I mean, you have people like TCB, Blackstone. What has been the journey too of going through all these financing cycles with external with outside investors?
Yeah, we actually bootstrapped for a very long time. At least if you look at SaaS companies, sometimes it feels like everyone's discussing how to raise money and how much. But we bootstrapped for 10 years. And that means that we were profitable. So we managed to get enough money in to do R&D and pay people and do all those things. But then we had decided that we wanted to go into the US market. So up until 2015, we had expanded within Europe. And that's something you can do in a fairly lean way because there's not too many time zones and distances aren't very long. You can have a lot of centralized support in one place to serve many markets. But then when we had decided that we want to enter the US market in 2015, we knew that we just need more resources. It's not something a bootstrapping company, or at least we, would have been able to do. So that's when we first raised money. And then subsequently, we've done, I think, three like real rounds of fundraising. And they all have had slightly different focuses, but I don't think they have been overly complicated or painful or difficult. There's, of course, quite a lot of due diligence involved, which is super important. But from our perspective, having that track record of consistent growth you know, a decade of growth before we even raised that first round, and then continuing on that growth track, and also being able to show that we have the unit economics to make this profitable as soon as we stop investing aggressively in expansion. I think that made the discussions quite kind of, let's say, clear in that sense that we had our story, but we also had the proof points. And I think that's something that the investors quite liked, and all of them have been following us for quite a while before actually investing in Redux. So I think they have been, you know, keeping a close eye on us, which means that they are pretty familiar with the business, with the clients, the word on the street, which just makes it easier from our perspective to have those conversations.
So obviously with investment, you know, there comes a big responsibility, you know, and ultimately investors, they're betting on vision, you know, and I find that that vision too is going to enroll employees, customers, you know, into the future that you're ultimately living to as well, no? So I guess in your case, imagine if you guys were all to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision, where the vision of Relax is fully realized. What does that world look like, Joanna?
Well, there's many facets to it, but one thing I think is highly motivating and very meaningful is that that would be a world where we have consumer goods supply chains with zero waste. So zero wasted products, highly automated execution, very meaningfully, impactfully, less emissions, both from products, but also from transportation, you know, distribution, getting it to the consumers' homes. So that's really kind of where we are aiming to go, remove all that unnecessary waste, making the whole supply chain a lot more sustainable. But of course, also, and that's actually one of the nicest things about working with supply chains. Some people find them quite boring. That's fine. I'm not going to try to convince you otherwise. It's a bit of an acquired taste, but it certainly goes hand in hand with sustainability and resource use. And that's something that should be really kind of top of mind for everyone in today's world.
So can you expand a little bit more into how you guys are all thinking about AI, you know, and then also Gen AI as well, as you're thinking about the future of Relax?
Yeah. So of course, AI is super impactful in our area, as probably most of the technology companies would say. What rubs me a bit the wrong way about AI is that you know, sometimes people feel that it's AI, it's one AI, it's not one AI. There's so many facets to AI. There's so many different technologies under that umbrella. But for example, for us, machine learning, super big. All our demand forecasting is based on machine learning. And what that means is that we can really finally make use of all that rich data that is out there and pour it into the system and see what really adds value and makes sense without having a lot of people plowing through all that's available and trying to understand where to apply it and where not. So that's been quite a game changer. Really makes a huge business difference. Then Gen AI, the hype of today, also super exciting. So of course, we use it internally quite a bit in these kind of knowledge intensive roles that we have a lot of. It's very handy for many tasks. But we've also packaged a lot of our product and process knowledge into documentation. We are kind of a fairly documentation oriented company. We like to write things down. And that's been so powerful because now we can make that knowledge, that documented knowledge, available to our clients as well. So we've launched our own Relax Rebot that replies to clients' questions. It can be like nitty-gritty things like, how does this parameter impact my order proposals? Or it can be something more broad like, I have a challenge with my promotions. What are the things I should be looking at? And that's actually quite cool because documentation is something we did for us to make it possible for us to serve our clients better. But now we can remove ourselves as the man in the middle from that equation and give our clients kind of direct access to our consultants' brains. And that's pretty cool. But then there's plenty of other cool application areas. So something I'm quite excited about is also that we've developed some AI capabilities to suggest promotions to our clients. So I mentioned earlier that there's a lot of bad promotions out there that aren't really doing anything for anyone. And one thing is to be able to analyze and prune them out. But now this is the next level, having a solution that actually suggests what products to promote with what, you know, promotion tactics and at what price point to get the outcomes that your kind of business strategy has set for you. And that's pretty cool.
So imagine I was to put you into a time machine and I was to bring you back in time, Joanna. I bring you back to 2006, you know, maybe that moment where you were still at the Helsinki University of Technology and now you're talking to your co-founders. And it's just at the moment where you're giving the notice and venturing into the unknown. Let's say you have the opportunity of stopping your younger self coming out of the building of the Helsinki University of Technology, and you're able to stop that younger self on the tracks, and you're able to give that younger Joanna and perhaps your other co-founders one piece of advice before starting the business. What would that be and why, now that you're in almost two decades, you know, into the business?
Yeah, I'd be super hesitant when it comes to advice, even to myself. Because the thing is, you know how things ended up happening, but you don't know what the alternative looked like. So sometimes you make a mistake and you feel bad about it and be like, ah, should have done something different here. But then there's a series of events and, you know, maybe you didn't get that client, but then you got the other client. Maybe that was actually better in the end. So maybe the advice is that don't worry too much about the mistakes. You know, there's going to be mistakes. There's always mistakes. The key is to learn from them fast. Why did it happen? Was this avoidable? Was it just random? You know, what can I take away from this? How can I learn faster? And then the other thing is that as long as you do everything you do with integrity, you're not going to have any regrets.
I love that. So, Joanna, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, I think LinkedIn is probably the easiest one. You just need to figure out how to write my name. I think that's the key challenge. But if you manage to find one Johanna Smorus there's only one in the world at the moment. So that should be pretty simple.
My God, quite unique. Yeah, Joanna, I love it. I'm very straightforward. So, hey, well, thank you so very much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.